Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
This episode of Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you would like to learn how to support this podcast, visit www.patreon.com/writingexcuses.
Hey, listeners. We want your input on season 20, which, I have to be honest, does not sound like a real number. What elements of the craft do you want us to talk about? What episode or core concept do you use or reference or recommend the most? Or what are you just having trouble with? After 20 seasons, we've talked about a lot of things. What element of writing do you wish we'd revisit for a deeper dive on the podcast? Email your ideas to podcast@writingexcuses.com. Season 19, Episode 21. This is Writing Excuses.
A close reading on world building, language as a tool.
15 minutes long.
Because you're in a hurry.
And we're not that smart.
I'm Mary Robinette.
I'm Dong Wan.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Howard.
So this week, continuing our close reading series on Arkady Martin's A Memory Called Empire, I wanted to dig into three very specific sections over the course of this book. Last week, we focused heavily on the opening. And here, I want to talk about how Arkady uses language as a tool, and both how she phrases things, her word choices, but also the way in which she uses the language of this culture, and then, well, the culture of this culture, the literature, the poetry, the pop culture, to communicate certain very important concepts about the book. So the first one I really want to drill down on is on page 19, as she's approaching the city. We touched on this very briefly last time, but there's a moment where Iskander, her imago in her head, says the world, and he says it in Texcalanli. So the quote here is, he said it in the Texcalanli language, which made it a tautology. The word for world and the word for the city were the same, as was the word for empire. It was impossible to specify, especially in the high imperial dialect. One had to note the context. This is such a fascinating idea to me, and this communicates so much about this culture. I found, when I read this book for the first time, that sentence was dripping with menace for me. That was one of the scariest sentences in this book, because the idea that this culture sees themselves as so important that their city is a tautology for the entire empire is fascinating. This is all ours, right? Going back to last episode, we talked about how they were looking at the star chart, and this is moment where they're like, all these tiny pinpricks are like, that's ours. And then we see this concept, not just in how they think about it, but embedded into the language. And because of the way language works, they cannot think about it another way. There's no way for them to linguistically communicate the difference between us and our empire. They are the empire in the most fundamental, hardwired ways into their culture.
As an extension of this, I don't remember specific examples from the book, but there's this idea that words like human and people and other are defined in such a way that if you are not Texcalanli, you might not qualify as human just based on the word that gets used. You might not qualify as people. And the inherent othering of everybody who is not a member of the empire is also dripping with menace.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I marked is that there, and this happens with a lot of languages, that the word that they have for her, someone who is from outside the empire, is barbarian. And that's, you know, barbarian, alien. And there's a point deeper in the book where someone corrects and says foreigner. And it was like, no, that's not the right, that's not the language that we use. We say foreigner. But it made me think of, in Icelandic, the word for foreigner is utlander, which is literally outlander. Mm-hmm. You know, someone who's not from here. My family will say us folks. And to mean anyone that is connected to our family or friends, like us folks. And this demarcation that she does in her world building with this by identifying you are either part of the empire, mm-hmm. or you are less than human. Like the way that the language is structured is such really yummy world building.
There's an aspect of this we're going to touch on in an episode I'll be driving shortly, which is the line where she says, "What do you mean by us? Mm-hmm. What do you mean by we? What do you mean by me?" We come back to that all the time as we are having arguments about about grouping and alliance and identity, and it is delicious to me. So delicious to me.
Well, there's that moment also fairly early on in the book where they end up playing a little game where they each have to tell a truth when asked about it. And Three Seagrass is forced to admit that she likes aliens.
Yeah.
And it is treated as this perversion. It's treated as this embarrassing fact of like, oh my God, I can't believe you like that. And, you know, I don't know what the comparison is in our culture, but you can feel when you establish culture in this way, when you establish language in this way, then suddenly the idea of liking an alien does suddenly feel perverse. You can suddenly see how inside this culture, if they don't even have a word that isn't exclusionary, that of course it'd be strange to want to be close to something that is not us.
Yeah. You mentioned Three Seagrass, and that's one of the really cool language things I want to get into is the naming conventions that they use in this culture. Three Seagrass is kind of sort of a main character, but everyone has a name kind of like that. And Arkady goes and explains like that they use a number and then they use a word. My favorite name, and I can't remember exactly, but it was 17 all-terrain vehicle.
It was 36.
There it is.
All-terrain tundra vehicle.
Yeah.
This is one of my favorite parts of this book. It is a line that made me laugh so hard when I first read it. And, you know, it's also a very emotionally significant line for me because one of the things this book is about the concept of assimilation, right? And names are very fraught. When you are a child of immigrants or when you're an immigrant to another culture, names become a very difficult, fraught topic, right? I'm unusual among my peers because I use a Korean name. I don't use an Americanized name. Most of the other Koreans I know or other Asian Americans in general have names that are very typical, usually very Judeo-Christian names picked out of a baby book or picked from the Bible. I don't have that, right? Well, I do have one. I'm not telling you what it is because I hate it more than anything. I do have an American name. My brother has an American name. We both used our Korean-style names. And that choice has been one that has been an ongoing challenge for me over the course of my life because my name, unfortunately, also happens to sound like a famous character from literature. So I get one joke every single time I introduce myself to a new person, and that is repeated over and over again. I also have a thing where I cannot quite pronounce my name correctly. And, you know, you'll hear me say it in a mostly Americanized way on the show, which is Dong Wan, which is how I've, for years and years, introduced myself to, you know, white Americans. I have recently been shifting a little bit to something closer to the Korean pronunciation, which is more like Dong Wan. That has been a shift I've been trying to make. It's kind of hard to do because I'm used to saying it a certain way. But all of this is to say that names are so important because they identify you in the culture. They can be exclusionary and they can be an invitation in. So this idea that this person came to this culture and named themselves 36 all-terrain tundra vehicle, which is hilarious to us as the audience, but it is also hilarious to the people in the culture. The line that comes after that is a revelation that produced in Mahit and Three Seagrass a kind of stunned silence. No one would actually name a child that, Three Seagrass complained after a moment. He has no taste. This idea of taste is so important because this is clearly someone who wasn't born to this culture. They identify that immediately. And this person has desperately reached for something that sounds right to them. They're like, well, that's a number and that's a noun, but it's an absurd noun. Yeah. And it's the wrong kind of number.
For English speakers, there is an unwritten, mostly, rule about adjective order. We can tell when adjectives are in the wrong order. And you will often see people string together adjectives in instruction manuals or whatever, and you realize, oh, you didn't get the memo about the way adjectives are supposed to work. Mm-hmm. And the fake AP style book said adjectives should be listed in increasing awesomeness. The blue, Italian, rocket-propelled, monkey-piloted motorcycle. And I've always laughed at that because it follows both rules, and I was reminded of that by, you know, 36 all-terrain tundra vehicle. Three seagrass is given pause because, oh, that's technically right, but you ran afoul of a very different rule.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the amount of world building that's communicated in this, right? Because the names are one of the striking things. As soon as we meet three seagrass, as soon as we meet 12 azalea, six direction, all these people, we get the sense of like, wow, what a weird way to name people, right? Like from our perspective as the reader, it feels alien and cool. And this joke is an opportunity for the author to say, okay, here's what's going on. Here's how this works.
Yeah.
You pick a number, you pick a noun. These kinds of nouns are good. These kind of numbers are good. And like, you know, you get a sense, it's an opportunity for just to stop and tell us, you know, going back to show, don't tell, this is her way of saying, I'm going to take a break here. I'm going to explain what's going on with these so that you've experienced the delight of running to them the first time. We're, you know, far enough into the book that I can slow down and tell you what's going on here.
And just to talk about the specific mechanics of one of the things that Arkady is doing with this, when she slows down and explains it, she is also making it about something else. She's making it about a bonding moment between these two characters. And she's also using, there's a brief flashback that Mahit has where she remembers vividly the part of her early language training on Ocel when her entire class had been encouraged to make up Texaclani names to call themselves while they were learning to speak. And she'd picked Nine Orchid because it was the heroine of her favorite book. And she's having this moment where she's explaining it to us, and it's a tell moment because she's like, this is how these names work. But she's also masking it by having it be doing some load bearing on character, doing load bearing on history. She's having this moment do multiple different things. So when you have something like this that you need to explain to your reader, look at the different things it can be doing so that it's not just, wait, let me stop the story.
Yeah. Exactly.
To me, this got a pass because I laughed at the name.
Yes.
And anytime you can make me laugh, that page had a reward. Thank you for making me read it.
Yeah. Well, and I will also say the other thing that happens for me is that because she slows down here, when much deeper in the book, when Six Helicopter comes in, we know that his name is also absurd. And so we are in the joke with everybody else who's having that moment.
Well, and again, and all of this speaks to the core thematics of the book. Mm-hmm. It's a funny moment. It's a character moment. It's all these things, but it's also a moment that is about empire and how it works. The thing that she talks about in terms of the flashback is a thing that if you go to an Asian country, they're in a language school, they're all picking American names, right? In South Asia, in Korea, in Japan, China, they're going to pick an American name so that they have that thing in the same way that, you know, Mahit picks Nine Orchid to be her Texcalanli name. And she's reflecting all these real world themes, rooting it in things that are familiar to us so that we understand what empire means and how that works in our world. On that note, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to keep unpacking some of these very specific examples of language.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio.
See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
The Gilded Age on Max is the latest offering from Julian Fellowes, best known for Downton Abbey. This is set in 1882 in New York City among the ultra-wealthy. It's got social battles between new money and the established social crowd. It looks at class and race and also just straight-up romance. I'll be honest, the plots are not surprising, but they are somehow still captivating and moving. Sometimes I get a little mad when I'm crying because I could see it coming, but I was still excited to get there. It's a good example of why formulas can work. Also, the costumes. If you are at all into fashion and history, the costumes are exhaustively researched and are often replica of extant gowns or paintings. Check out The Gilded Age for a lot of very pretty, pretty clothes.
All right, so one thing that I wanted to talk about here is another neat trick that Arcady is using. The culture is kind of, sort of, well, at least linguistically, has a lot of Aztec influence in it.
Yes.
Texcalan is an overtly Aztec-ish word. And one of the reasons that I suspect she may have made that decision is precisely because the words are hard to pronounce.
Mm.
Right? Mm-hmm. Texcalan, which would be Texcalan in actual Aztec, I think it was an overt, purposeful choice to pronounce it more westernized than that, just to kind of continue the theme of cross-culture stuff. That's the name of the empire and the name of the city and the name of the planet. Something that comes from Texcalan is Texcalanli. The word for a person who is from Texcalan, or the people from there, is Texcalanlitzlim. And you get these words and you kind of stumble over them. And I think that that's on purpose,
mm-hmm.
As a way of really hitting home, this is different. This is outside of your realm of experience. This is outside of your comfort zone. You are trying to assimilate these very difficult linguistic concepts. It also signals to the reader that language matters.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I am going to make you figure out how to say Texcalanlitzlim, and you're going to do it. And that is going to let you know to pay close attention to the language, because it is worth this effort.
Mm-hmm. And she's doing the thing where she manages to make the reader feel the subjectivity of what it is to be an immigrant,
mm-hmm.
right? She forces the reader into the position of being a foreigner to a culture, which, you know, I think we talked about audience surrogates earlier, but this is such like a grounded way and such a material way to make that felt. And the way she does that is by introducing, you know, a conlang in some ways, right? A constructed language in some ways. We don't get all of it, but we get some hints of it. And introducing culture, the poetry, the epic poems, the you know, different refrains, you know, even when we get, you know, a couplet that is an epithet for a person, right? When nine ads appears, 19 ads or nine ads?
19
ads. There's that beautiful epithet that she has about the edge shine of a knife,
yeah.
right? And what a remarkable, striking moment. And wow, did that establish a character immediately.
Yeah.
Like, what, to be referred to poetically as the edge shine of a knife, how terrifying that person
yeah.
must be.
One of the things that she never did, that Arcady never did, was use the word meme. And mm-hmm. and the Texcalanli culture is, especially with the poetry, is inherently mimetic.
Yes.
Mm.
All the time, people will make references, will say things, and Mahit realizes, oh, that last thing is a line from this poem about the buildings. And so what you're saying is not just thing, but also referencing a building. Mm-hmm. That idea comes back over and over. And I mean, we see it in our own culture, you know, as people will make pop culture references. Oh, I understood that joke.
Yeah.
And everybody is now on board. I loved that she did it and was frankly amazed that she did it without ever using the word meme.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's a great comparison. You know, as someone who's chronically online, I'm capable of having a conversation with my friends that is impenetrable to an outsider, you know, based mm-hmm. on the number of memes and references that we're making. And I want to show how this is used in the text in a way that I found particularly fascinating. This is another one of my very favorite moments. It's from page 86, for those of you who have the print edition. This is when the bomb in the cafe goes off, which Howard mentioned a couple episodes. So, she knew the Tezcalanli word for explosion, a centerpiece of military poetry usually adorned with adjectives like shattering or fire-flowered. But now she learned, by extrapolation from the shouting, the one for bomb. It was a short word. You could scream it very loudly. She figured it out because it was the word people were screaming when they weren't screaming help. I am obsessed with this paragraph. Yeah. It is so powerful. It is so upsetting. It communicates the true horror of what has just happened to her and the people around her. And it tells us so much about Mahit as well. Mm-hmm. That her first thing is to go to this cerebral abstraction.
Yep.
She retreats into academic thought and poetry before she returns to the word that they're screaming when they're not screaming help. Right.
And also that there is a genre of military poetry.
Yes, exactly. And so in the way that Howard is talking about this sort of mimetic way of having culture, the word for explosion is part of that, right? There are beautiful poems about fire-flowered explosions, but nobody talks about bombs.
Well, and that's that goes back to our conversation about scale and this concept of, you know, how close are you to the subject that mm-hmm. you're talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Because from far away, you can talk about a fire-flowered explosion and it sounds really cool. But when you're down there on the street, surrounded by rubble and smoke, it is a bomb. You need a word you can scream loudly.
You are lying on the ground thinking, I learned a new word.
And also, who would teach you the word bomb to go on a diplomatic mission? You don't need to know that.
No. It reminds me briefly of when I was learning Icelandic. I initially was doing, you know, I speak Icelandic a little bit. But there were two texts that I had a choice from, one of which taught me phrases like, where is the train station? And there are no train stations in Iceland. There is no circumstance under which you would need to be able to say, where is the train station in Icelandic? Because you would have to be someplace else where, like, there aren't Icelandic speakers outside of Iceland, except in Minnesota.
This is that damn Duolingo owl trying to convince me that I need to know how to say the cat is under the pizza table.
Yes. But one of the other books, in the first or second chapter, one of the words that you learned was decapitation. And I was like, this person has read Icelandic epics.
Yes.
And that for me is one of the things about these is like, you know, the other thing that is in this is like, what is valorized?
Yeah.
What is valorized? And a bomb is not valorized. And, you know, explosions, yes, but explosions from starships that are, you know, mm-hmm. and warheads that are coming down, but not a handmade bomb in a cafe. That's not a valorous experience.
And correct me if I am misremembering, because it has been a few years since I have read this, other than skimming it for these episodes. Don't they come back later and propagandize this explosion a little bit, this bomb,
mm-hmm.
and just the language that they use to talk about it changes. It isn't a bomb anymore. It's a fire-flowered explosion. They're using mm-hmm. it for political purposes by changing the words they use to describe it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They're taking it from being common to being elevated. Yeah.
Right. And so, again, this is one of those moments where so many layers of the story and character and world are in this, right? So just, you know, to recap in some ways, she's, again, explaining culture, how the culture works by starting in this poetic way, explaining the stakes of the book because, hey, Mahit could get blown up. Her life is at risk, right? She's communicating a different kind of risk than we've seen before. Up until now, it's been political. It's been, you know, words. Bombs are in play now, right? She's lying trapped under rubble while the person she came to meet is his blood is dripping on her face. It's a visceral, terrifying moment. But more than anything else, she's using this moment to communicate such fear and helplessness and pain. The way this shifts into this such an emotional place by the end of it with that, like the word people were screaming, right? Like it's so grounding and it's so scary and it's so upsetting to communicate what violence actually is. And that establishes such the themes of the book of, we can talk about it at this abstract level, but the reality is this, and don't forget that.
One of the first things that I try to do when I'm in a new place with a new language is learn how humor works so that I might reach that high bar of being able to tell a joke. And the moment that I was hoping for in this book, quietly, but hoping nonetheless, with all of Mahit's appreciation of poetry and Three Seagrasses standing as an actual poet, thought, wow, if that was me, the real horror would be, what if I have to write a poem? And the stand up and cheer moment for me in this book was Mahit and Three Seagrass have to write a poem upon which their life literally depends.
Yeah.
And I loved that so much. And the language aspect of the book supported it in a way that stood up and cheered.
Yeah.
World building is storytelling.
Yeah, absolutely. And she does a really great job of, one of the things for you, reader, when you're thinking about this is how many different ways can you use a piece of world building? And so she's using language to do multiple different things, which is part of why when we talk about muscular writing, that's what we're talking about, is having it do more than one thing.
And this was such a big flex. Such a big flex.
I think we'll leave it on that. I have a little bit of homework for you. I would love for you to write a scene that describes a fictional piece of literature, whether it's a poem, a song, a story, comic book, that means something to the people in the story that you are telling.
This has been Writing Excuses. You're out of excuses. Now go write.
Do you like stars? I do. Maybe you'd like to put up a constellation of stars by rating us on Apple Podcasts. Hello. Yes, we're talking about ratings, not astronomy. But a 5-star review can help us by creating a navigational beacon for new writers like you to find their way to Writing Excuses. So, rate us on Apple Podcasts or your podcast platform of choice. Let's talk about the rude tales of magic. In this improvised narrative role-playing podcast, join artists, writers, and comedians from Adult Swim, Cartoon Network, Comedy Central, Marvel Comics, and more as they fight and fumble their way across the madcap and exceedingly rude fantasy wasteland of Cordelia. Branson Reese and his jester's retinue, Christopher Hastings, Carly Monardo, Tim Platt, Joe Lepore, and Ali Fisher star as a group of unlikely survivors, specifically a talking crow, a lich in a wig, a bubbly fawn, a Sasquatch punk, and a tiefling hunk. This group must solve the mystery of Polaris University's vanishment and return balance and higher education to their world. It's going to be very hard and very, very rude. Subscribe to Rude Tales of Magic on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. New episodes drop every Wednesday.
Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. For this episode, your hosts were Mary Robinette Kowal, Dong Wan Song, Dan Wells, and Howard Taylor. This episode was engineered by Marshall Carr Jr., mastered by Alex Jackson, and produced by Emma Reynolds. For more information, visit writingexcuses.com.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.